State versus Hine may approach. Again, this is State versus Hine, and counsel for the appellant, you may approach and present your argument.
Are we pronouncing his name correctly?
Quinn, Your Honor.
Quinn, thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Matthew Meyerly. I'm an attorney with Lancaster County Public Defender's Office here today on behalf of Dustin Huynh. We're appealing the district court's denial of Mr. Huynh's motion to transfer his case to the juvenile court of Lancaster County. We're asking the court to find that the district court abused its discretion in denying Dustin's motion to transfer the case to juvenile court, based primarily on the totality of all of the factors that the court considered and is required to consider under 43-276. What we think makes Dustin's case different than other juvenile transfer appeals which have come before this court are the combination of limited prior criminal history, no prior criminal history whatsoever, no prior involvement in the juvenile court system, and further, that there was no evidence of violence in this case. In other cases that have come before this court where a juvenile had limited criminal history, such as State versus LaRue or the State versus Blimling case, those were violent felony offenses, homicide or attempted murder.
We did have a loaded gun inside the car, though, correct?
There was a loaded gun located inside the car, Your Honor, that's correct. However, there's no indication that the gun was ever used or brandished. We don't agree necessarily that there was evidence of violence. We think that the court must consider the plain language of 43-276, that being specifically, as it relates to the violence factor, whether or not there is evidence that the offense included violence. In this case, the simple presence of the firearm does not transform the matter into a violent offense. Moreover, we think that the court has an obligation specifically under 43-276 to consider Dustin's age. The court, in its analysis of the age factor, again, focused on the presence of drugs, the presence of money, but did not independently consider Dustin's age.
Isn't really that... I don't think that helps you very much here, does it, his age?
Your Honor, we think that the age is significant in combination with the fact that Dustin has no prior juvenile court involvement. This is not like the other individual whose case information we presented to the district court, who had a lengthy history of juvenile court involvement.
But he was 17 at the time of the crime.
He was 17 at the time of the offense, and the juvenile code does provide for concurrent jurisdiction over those class 2 felonies between a juvenile court and a district court.
Has he been adjudicated yet?
No, it has not been adjudicated yet. During the appeal, jurisdiction is divested.
So if we were to agree with you and send it back, he would still have to, well, you'd probably see a PFR first, but then you'd still have to go back and adjudicate him. And so my understanding from reading the record is he is either 18 now or will be turning 18 this month.
He will be turning 18 this month.
So then he would age out in a year.
He will be turning 18 this month. If the court remands the matter with instructions that it be transferred to juvenile court, the evidence at the transfer hearing was that there's approximately 6 weeks between a case being filed in juvenile court and then the matter being adjudicated in juvenile court. So that's 6 weeks. During the pendency of those 6 weeks, the juvenile court would have the authority to provide for temporary orders, provide for a conditional release, provide for other provisions to for the security of the public as well as for Dustin's individual well-being, such as orders that he cooperate with therapy, evaluations, things of that nature. That was, at the time that the hearing took place, one of our primary arguments was that an expeditious and a timely transfer of the case would give the juvenile court the maximum period of time with which to work with Dustin. And again, we think that at the time of the transfer hearing, that was approximately 17, 18 months, during which the juvenile court had the ability to continue to work with him. And that 18 months, the evidence was at the transfer hearing, all of the services that were testified to can be completed in 18 months.
But didn't Ms. Champeau testify that sometimes, yes, they can be successful in rehabilitating within that 18-month time frame? Sometimes, yes.
Sometimes, yes, but sometimes is still, I mean, I certainly had cases
where... Isn't that the problem with these cases when you have the juveniles at that age, you know, where they're coming up on that 19, where they would no longer be eligible to stay in the juvenile court, and a district court judge is in a position of having to decide, can we fully rehabilitate this juvenile in the limited time that we have left? And how do you decide that? I mean, especially when I think there's some assertions of mental health issues. I don't recall what all the evidence was with regard to his mental health, but if there are mental health issues, district courts are more likely going to err on the side of caution that there's sufficient time to treat that. Wouldn't you agree?
I think that it's important for the district court to err on the side of caution, but I would submit that when a child is 17, that erring on the side of caution would provide for the possibility that that child's best interests and rehabilitation can be best served through a transfer to juvenile court, because juvenile court has the ability to provide focused, specific, intensive services, which the adult probation office or the Department of Correctional Services doesn't have the same ability to provide. The legislature, when they drafted 43-247, did not say that district court shall have concurrent jurisdiction unless a child is close to turning 18. They provide for a length of jurisdiction.
Yeah, that's true. And then the legislature, I mean, we have an abuse of discretion standard of review here, right? So the district court judge makes a decision. We really can't tinker with it unless we conclude there was an abuse of discretion. So the evidence would have to be so lopsided and not support what the district court judge did.
Well, and I think that in this case, the court did abuse its discretion by, for example, when determining that the violence factor favored retention in the district court, again, focused merely on the presence of the firearm rather than the presence of violence. By focusing on the fact that considerations of the juvenile's ability to appreciate the nature and seriousness of his conduct were instead just, it's well known that this combination of factors puts public safety at risk. There was no actual consideration of Dustin's subjective ability to appreciate the nature and seriousness of his conduct. So we believe that the district court did abuse its discretion when it denied the transfer based on the totality of its reasoning and based on the totality of the circumstances. Your Honor, if I could reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. All right. Mr. Lewis.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Matt Lewis, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the state of Nebraska in this case. This is an interlocutory appeal of the order of the District Court of Lancaster County denying appellant's motion to waive jurisdiction to the separate juvenile court. Appellant raises the single issue in his appeal, alleging an abuse of discretion by the district court in not granting his motion to transfer. The state submits that there was no abuse of discretion. As provided in the state's brief, State versus Blewett holds that an abuse of discretion occurs when a trial court's decision is based on reasons that are untenable or unreasonable, or if its action is clearly against justice or conscience, reason, and evidence. This court here also held in State versus Blimling that when a court's basis for retaining jurisdiction is supported by the appropriate evidence, It cannot be said that the district court abused its discretion in refusing to transfer the case to juvenile court.
What about Mr. Meyerly's argument that the court was viewing the gun as evidence of being a violent crime, and that you really, the factor says whether or not the offense involved violence?
Well, in its analysis, in the four-page order that the district court put together, it doesn't view the handgun by itself, one. It ties the presence of the handgun, a loaded stolen firearm, that is located within sort of the curtilage of the appellant, next to his driver's license in the glove box of the automobile, used in the commission of CDS sales, being used is, I think the phraseology is for protection in the furtherance of those sales. And then the district court also looked at the juvenile intake summary, which classifies this as a violent offense. And the district court quoted that in its order, that the juvenile intake summary sees this as a violent offense and partially relies on that in order to reach that conclusion.
I mean, the other charges related to marijuana,
correct?
Right? I mean, so these were marijuana charges, and had that gun not been in that glove box, probably we wouldn't be here. I'm just guessing. Because it would have been a marijuana possession situation, right? Or
right.
Potential to sell. So it's a gun in a glove box. Is a gun in a glove box a violent, having a gun in your glove box, a violent offense? Because the factor says there is evidence that the alleged offense included violence.
Correct. And I'm not trying to create a fact where there isn't one in trying to allege that it was being used in a shooting. I'm not saying that there was a discharge of the firearm. I'm not saying it was used as a blunt object to strike somebody. But there is sort of an anticipation of violence. And then also the link between drug sales and firearms, I think, is inherently violent. And I think that it is not so far afoul for the district court to see that as sort of inherently violent or violent in nature.
Was there any evidence from witnesses or photographs that showed any kind of demonstrable use of the firearm?
There are not necessarily discharge of the firearm. However, there is evidence that the firearm is tied to the appellant. You have the driver of the automobile says, yes, it's his gun. He carries it. He's a drug dealer. I know he's a drug dealer. He uses it for protection. There are also photographs that are pulled off of social media where he is posing with the gun and smoking weed and you know, holding the gun. So there are no photographs or video or anything like that that shows him using the firearm as a firearm would be used in a discharge fashion. But there are, I would use that to also sort of pivot and say that the firearm is linked to him, and the evidence sort of points to him as the owner and possessor of that firearm and not somebody else in the car, which I think would change the facts a little bit too.
What about the fact that, you know, this case was a little bit unusual because we didn't have the prior juvenile record. It appeared that he was attending school and on the track for graduation. So we didn't have the prior criminal record or gang affiliation that we often see in these kind of cases.
Yeah, that is correct. And again, I'm not trying to create, a prior criminal history or juvenile history where there isn't one. I think, you know, the district court recognizes that he doesn't have a prior criminal history or juvenile history and, chalks that up to his favor, I think, in the transfer analysis. But in the overall sort of, if we pull back and we look at abuse of discretion, we're looking at all the factors together, and we're looking at the offense itself, and that this is, you know, kind of the deep end of the pool when it comes to offenses as well. We're not talking about somebody that's just selling a little bit of weed after school, maybe has a little bit of weed on them in the car when they get pulled over. I mean, he is. We're talking about nearly 80 grams of marijuana and THC wax. There's evidence that there are other drug sales that have been completed that evening. He's got a firearm for the purposes of selling, of completing his CDS sales. I believe that there's a comment somewhere in the police report that he had retrieved drugs from out of state somewhere. He has got people that are in the car using social media to help him sell drugs.
Okay, so let me just stop you there because those are all really good points. And so if the facts were a little different and he was in possession of just a very small amount of marijuana, but that was still a gun tied to him in the glove box, do you think that would have changed how this case should have been approached?
I think that it could have changed how the case would be approached. I mean, I can't speculate. Given the fact in the standard that there are sort of no weights assigned to the factors that the district court puts forward, I, I can't speculate as to how much or how much that sort of broke the plane of.
Yeah, because I'm trying to wrap my head around this whole idea that if there's a gun in the glove box, which is a bad thing, okay, don't get me wrong, but if we're saying that we're going to count that as being a violent act in some way by itself, just the fact that you have a gun in your glove box, the repercussion of that conclusion, you know, in subsequent cases is what I'm a little concerned about. And so I think I hear you saying, if you look at all the factors in this case tied to that gun in the glove box, that's different maybe from a case where we have very little contraband in the car and no signs of selling or something. Is that kind of where you're coming from?
Yeah, and there are also, just a quick look prior to coming in today, there are other cases where there have been people that have been looking at the transfer analysis, facts a little bit different, but have not had prior criminal histories, and the court still decided to retain based on sort of other factors.
Because this kid has a pretty clean background.
Correct, yeah.
Right?
I think the only thing leading up to this are some truancy problems in the year leading up to the offense.
Do you think if he'd have been 14 instead of 17, would that have made a big difference here?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think that is a fact pattern that lends itself better to.
Because there would have been more time for rehabilitation and things like that.
Yeah, rehabilitation and supervision, which is also something that the district court gets into, the amount of time to watch him.
But if he was 14 and actually held the gun, I mean, you know, these are the things that the trial judge has to look at, right? And that's why our review is limited to an abuse of discretion, because they're there, they're able to assess, you know, the evidence more closely. So in this case, the one factor that I, and the way the judge talks about that factor, it seems to suggest the violence factor weighed pretty heavily in the judge's decision, and the aging out factor. And that's a tough thing, you know, for kids who are 16, 17, in that age range. Are district court judges just going to routinely have to say, you know, since they're going to age out of juvenile court at age 19, we can't be certain they can be rehabilitated. So for the safety of society, we have to put them in adult court. Then it feels like we're defeating the purpose of this legislation that's designed to rehabilitate our youth rather than putting them into prison. So, you know, you're coming from the state's perspective. Are you able to conceive a situation where a 17-year-old's ever going to be sent to juvenile court?
I think that if the facts were a little bit different, even in this case, I think that if the presence of the gun were maybe different, if the gun had been maybe located in the trunk, unloaded, or if it wasn't stolen, or if it had been, if his tie to the handgun would have been a little bit more nebulous, if the amount of CDS would have been a little bit different, I think that all those things would have, you know, played a little bit differently into the analysis. But this appellant here, with this fact set up in this analysis, and pulling back and looking at all of the factors together, I think supports the district court's decision not to transfer.
That's helpful. Thank you.
Essentially, the appellant is arguing the district court did not provide the weighting of factors in the overall analysis he thinks that should have occurred. As outlined in the state's brief, this is not the standard. The district court need not resolve every factor against the juvenile or provide analysis in every factor against the juvenile. There are no weighted factors. There's no prescribed method by which more or less weight is assigned to a specific factor. The fact that this doesn't match up with the appellant's score sheet in retention versus transfer, or that every factor was resolved to his satisfaction, is of no moment here. In short, the evidence and testimony was presented, relevant consideration and reasoning was given by the district court, and it determined that retention was appropriate and denied the motion to transfer. This evidence was relevant, rational, and reasonable. It was supported by the record. The argument that appellant is making now is not congruous with the abuse of discretion standard nor the case law, and therefore, if there are no further questions, we ask this court to affirm.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
And how much time do we have for rebuttal? All right, Mr. Meyerly, you may approach.
Your Honor, I think when you talk about the risk that sort of limited time and a default to retain jurisdiction in the district court could potentially result in defeating the purpose of the legislation, the court hits on a very important fact. 43246provides for jurisdiction, provides that the juvenile code is to be exercised in cases where it's in the best interest of the juvenile to remove juveniles from the criminal justice system wherever possible. There's evidence in this case, and the court found that juvenile court services would be in Dustin's best interest. And the court further found that he could benefit from those services, that he was not non-amenable to juvenile court services.
Is it your position that, you know, the statute says the case shall be transferred to juvenile court unless a sound basis exists for retaining the case? So if a juvenile is 17 years old, is it always a sound basis to retain it because there's not enough time? There's no guarantee you can rehabilitate in that short time frame.
I think the state's position is that there's always a sound basis to retain in a 17-year-old situation because we just don't know if there's enough time. Our position is that with the combination, again, of factors that are present in Dustin's case, a child who has no prior juvenile court history, no prior history of intervention by the juvenile court system, that there is a sound basis to transfer the case because that person has essentially a tremendous ability to benefit from the services that can be provided through juvenile court. So our position is that the district court erred when it concluded that there was a sound basis to retain partially on the basis of the limited time that remained. That I see that I'm out of time, so we're asking the court to reverse the district court's determination and find that the court abused its discretion when it retained jurisdiction in Dustin's case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Meyerly. The case will be taken under submission. Thank you, Judge Bishop. And parties are excused.
Thank you, Your Honor.